Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
What's happening across Connecticut? Melissa in the Morning's conversation with Governor Ned Lamont. Now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Governor Lamont. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Melissa.
So I was excited yesterday to see that we're close to 50%, 75 plus, having their vaccinations. That's exciting. That's good, right?
That's really good news. I think within the next 10 days or so, we'll have the overwhelming majority of the 75 and above vaccinated, the group that's most vulnerable, the group that's most likely to, you know, suffer consequences, go to the hospital. Then we'll be moving to 65 and over, and we'll be laying out how to make your reservations there, you know, within a week or two.
Yeah, I actually had one of our listeners yesterday say, okay, so the governor said 10 days, which would mean February 11th. Is that still on track for the 65 plus? And I said, I will check. but unfortunately, I know I was reading, I think, Governor, that we're expecting like 17% more in our shipment next week. So hopefully that bumps us up with our vaccine numbers. But you're saying give or take around 10 more days and then like the 65 plus appointments can start?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And our shipments from the federal government, you know, Operation Warp Speed, that's up about, you know, like you said, 15-17%. But in addition, we're getting thousands of additional doses that go right to Walgreens and CVS, and we'll be ramping up the retail outlets as well. These are the guys that already give you flu shots, so they're pretty good at giving you the COVID vaccine as well.
So I was going to ask, actually, because I know this week was kind of all over the place with the snowstorm and trying to rebook those appointments. I already have calls coming in for next week because we're expecting snow on Tuesday, possibly again on Friday. People calling in, and specifically, like, I have Bridgeport residents who are hiking up to East Hartford. They want to know if snow ends up being a problem. Like, Hartford Healthcare did not cancel a lot of their clinics, but if people feel like they cannot make the trek up to East Hartford but they're supposed to on those snow days, what happens? Like, does Hartford Healthcare call them? What do they do so that they don't miss their opportunity or get pushed back in line?
Well, during the last snow, you know, a few days ago, we did close down, or the health providers closed down, you know, most of the vaccination facilities. They got everybody rescheduled, so by the end of this weekend, Super Bowl Sunday, all those people that had missed their appointment due to the snow have now caught up. And it's either you do that online on the van system, or the healthcare provider reaches out to you and they reschedules an appointment with you.
And I know you had mentioned that, like, CVS, Walgreens, I believe Walmart as well, like, they're going to start opening things up next week. Any, by any chance, any in our area? Do you know off the top of your head?
I can't tell you off the top of my head, but they're opening up. I think it's about a dozen, you know, as we speak, but they'll be rolling out from there. They do it on, you know, their schedule. They pick and choose. To be blunt, Melissa, we did ask them to redirect some of the CVSs to some of those urban areas where people are much likely to have gotten vaccinated, to make it easier for folks, you know, in Bridgeport and New Britain, to get vaccinated. Stanford, by the way, has done a very good job. Hats off, Stanford and Norwalk, you know, more, you know, city oriented, but they've really reached out to people and got people vaccinated.
Yeah, Stanford, I think, is like one of our golden children, just because I tell Mayor Martin all the time, I'm like, kudos to you. You're one of the only, at least in our area, like, they did the extra steps of putting together like a portal where, because VAMS, it's, you know, VAMS is obviously run by the federals, and it's come down here to Connecticut and every other state in some capacity. But I think, you know, you've got thousands of people all calling in or trying to use the online portal. And I think Stanford took that extra step and did things through either senior centers or through the city. And I just think they've done an excellent job giving just those helpful tips and helpful ways of getting people their appointments. So, yeah, that's been really, really good for them for sure.
And remember, we got the 211. So if you don't really dig the internet, give us a call. We have all the additional people there. We can handle by phone as well, so make it easier for people.
Perfect. Now, I wanted to know, Governor, what your thoughts were on this. New York this week talked about the fact that they are vaccinating, or making it a priority, I should say, to vaccinate taxi drivers, restaurant workers, people serving disabled communities. And I thought it was interesting because I know on Face the Nation recently, I think you had mentioned, like, we're making teachers a priority. I know here in Connecticut, I hear a lot from our bus drivers, our special educators specifically, that they are basically as frontline, almost like a healthcare worker. I mean, they're exposed every single day to people they don't know who have had COVID, like our bus drivers, for example. Even though kids are at a hybrid model, they're busing kids in every day, you know, by the dozens, by the hundreds. So when can they expect to get their vaccine? I think it's hard for them to understand why they've been kind of pushed back as like a priority.
Look, very soon. They are obviously in that broad category of essential worker, but I got to be blunt with you, Melissa. It's a big category. You mentioned taxi drivers. You mentioned the restaurant workers. How about folks who work in daycare every day, front and center? You know, how about the 1,000 people who go into an electric boat in a pretty tense, you know, a dense area, mm-hmm. Working on the submarines? So not to mention teachers who are in that classroom in front of 18 kids or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we've got to be careful as we figure out how we get the next group of people vaccinated. Age is one way, though. I mean, because age really is a determinant in terms of how much risk you are, not just for yourself, but to your broader community. And so that's why we started with the 65 and over. It's easy. You show a driver's license. We know you're from Connecticut. We know what your age is. And that will be, hundreds of thousands of people.
I do want to switch gears. I know there's some big debates happening in Hartford, but really quickly, I did get a question from one of our listeners, which I think is a good one and probably is a quick response. Somebody said they already got vaccinated, but they're going to Florida to visit family, and they wanted to know if when they come back, do they have to quarantine?
You do have to quarantine. What we do know about the vaccines, all of them, is they have great efficacy in protecting you. We don't know to what degree they keep you from being infectious to others. So the quarantine's got to stay in place a little
gotcha.
Bit longer.
Okay, that makes sense. I appreciate it. Thank you. All right, so I wanted to switch gears a little bit because there's a few really hot-button topics happening in well, there's a lot of things happening in Hartford, but a few things that have been really talked about here, especially in Fairfield and New Haven counties. First of all, big announcement this week. I want to just say kudos really quickly for the amount of work that clearly went into the Department of Motor Vehicle website. It is so much more, it's so much easier to use than I've ever remembered it being. So I know you guys have been working on it, and it looks fantastic. It's much easier to use, and I love the announcement about the fact that you can renew your licenses and your non-driver IDs. Like, I think that is great. The only thing, though, is that some people still don't want to use a computer or they don't have access to it. So they tried to call the DMV, and that number isn't working. So I don't know if you have any insight on that or what people should do if they don't have access to a computer, what your thoughts are.
Yeah, let me check on that. What happened is we deferred, we gave you extra time to get your license renewed due to COVID for good reasons. Now that time is coming up over the next couple of weeks, so there's a bit of a backlog. So a lot of people do want to get their licenses renewed, over the next month or two. You're right. The online version is working pretty well. About 40%, I think, Bongi told me, of everybody's doing it online, which means the lines at DMV and AAA are much lower, much smaller, much shorter than they would otherwise be. But if you've got a couple of folks who had a hard time getting through by telephone, it's a little like the vaccinations. If you can't figure out how to do it online, mm-hmm. a little slower on telephone, but we'll make sure we have the people there to address that.
And if people do it online, Governor, someone asked a question about paying online. You get added a tax. Is that true?
I don't know what that might be. Maybe the credit card processor has a small fee to process that. I got to look into that, Melissa.
Okay. I just wasn't sure because somebody had mentioned, like, why am I paying a tax online? I'll just go back to doing the lines. And I'm like, well, no, that's the whole point. It's like, stay online. Okay. I also just, this was actually me personally. So I was very excited about the renewal online. I'm curious, are you guys working on more stuff to be online for DMV? For example, like the real ID that we all have to get by October of 2021. I immediately checked all the documentations I have. I've got them already, but I know people personally who would love to just like submit that stuff online and get their real ID sent in the mail.
We're moving everything online.
You are.
Including the real ID,
yes.
Including all the licensing over it, consumer protection, including making it easier for people to register a business or get information on how to start up a business here in Connecticut. We had the biggest year, you know, in a long time during COVID of people starting up businesses, in part because it was easy. A little hats off to a guy named Josh Jabal. I mean, he oversees all that Department of Administrative Services. And usually you have a mayor or a state senator in their job. He had 12 years at IBM. So he brings a slightly different skill set to the table. And I think it's paying dividends for taxpayers in Connecticut.
Yeah, Josh is awesome. So what you're saying, Governor, is it's fine that I have not booked my in-person appointment to do my real ID. I could probably do it at some point online before October 2021.
I think so. I'll have to get back to you with the specifics, but I'm pretty sure.
Okay. That would be awesome because I don't want to go to the DMV. I want to stay online. So that would be great. Talking to Governor Ned Lamont this morning. Something else, though, that has come up. We have seen a massive spike. I don't know if it's happening in Hartford County, but in Fairfield and New Haven County, Governor, we have seen a humongous spike in car thefts. And the biggest thing that I'm hearing from police and some of our state representatives is it's because of the police accountability bill. We have virtually allowed our police officers no way of protecting us when a car theft happens. So, for example, I heard from a Stanford woman yesterday. She's a teacher. She was held up at gunpoint. Her car was stolen, and police basically said, look, ma'am, like, we're really sorry. We got to wait for the car to be ditched, or we got to wait for them to get out of the car and commit another crime because we can't chase them, we can't pursue them. And when we do arrest them, they basically get off scot-free. And I think criminals are taking advantage of that. So I wasn't sure if that's being looked at on a state level because it's a problem.
Yeah, I think that analysis is 90% wrong. But there's definitely been a spike in crime. There's definitely been a spike in carjackings. I'm afraid that's true in Connecticut. I'm afraid that's true in 49 other states, some of which had a police accountability. No, they didn't have a police accountability bill. I think some of that's related to the fact that too many of our kids aren't in school. What we have to do there, our police they're not sitting back. They're not waiting. They're being aggressive and enforcing the law. We're encouraging them to do so going forward. Carjackings, though, I got to look into that in particular. In the meantime, be careful with your car. I mean, these kids go, they check for keys, they check for ways to get this thing open. A lot of them are younger kids, so we got to make sure that we attract them and enforce that strictly.
But, like, I mean, true. I totally agree. I just think that, you know, and maybe you're right. Maybe it is that kids are out of school. But I also think it's, you know, I'm hearing specifically, like, from police lieutenants, officers, that they could do all they can, but they literally have said, like, by law, they have to wait for that car to be ditched or they have to watch the driver do something else wrong for them to intervene. And I'm wondering...
I'll have to look into that, Melissa. Maybe we don't want a lot of car chase scenes through downtown Stanford, and they're trying to find other ways to stop that car. You know, a lot of these cars with GPS, you can remotely stop them. You don't need that car chase scene. But let me look into that. But believe me, I understand what these crimes are. I understand what nuisance crimes are. We're being strict as can be. We got a whole extra class of state police coming on board. So we're going to have more state police this year than last year. We paid overtime for a lot of our police in the municipalities to make sure they have the people in place to make sure we can stay safe.
Mm-hmm. Governor Lamont, thank you so much for always coming on. I really appreciate it, and we'll talk in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Bye-bye.
All right. Have a great day.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you? Melissa in the Morning. Welcome Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600.
Good morning, Congressman Himes. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
Awesome. Can you give us the latest on the stimulus package? I know that's on a lot of people's minds for understandable reasons.
Yeah. So I woke up this morning, and apparently 2 hours ago at 5:30 in the morning, the Senate finished what's known as their vote-a-rama, and it's amendment after amendment on this bill, which got going in the House a couple of days ago. So it looks like it's got good momentum, and I can't tell you exactly what it's going to look like because I haven't looked at the results of this vote-a-rama, which apparently got done just 2 hours ago. No, it looks very good for passage. Again, I can't tell you exactly what's in there, but I'm pretty sure that the additional $1,400, you know, remember the $600 is out there and continues to go out there, an additional $1,400 in economic impact payment going to people. Probably most importantly, another slug of I think it may be up to $200 billion in money to really turbocharge the vaccine efforts, mm-hmm. and to get us, we're at about 1.5 million vaccines a day. And this additional money will allow us to really get that going and accelerate the point at which most people have access to vaccines. So we'll probably need to talk next week about exactly what's in it, but it looks like it's making good progress.
Okay. I mean, I think that's something that I can't imagine wherever you stand, we would argue about getting stimulus payments out to people. I think families and individuals, we need that money. I think a lot of people who qualify for it need to get that money. I also think you touched on a great thing, the vaccine rollout. Obviously, we want to get people more vaccinated just because there are more variants that are popping up and we need to kind of race against the clock. I did see in this bill that it also talks about money for schools, which I think is huge, to equip our schools. There was something in here, though, that I feel like comes up almost every time there's a stimulus package, and it's always up for debate. And I don't know if this is one of the biggest reasons that we're always kind of delayed in an answer for it. I could be wrong, but I find that this is always a point that's kind of controversial. And it's this idea of giving money to certain states, local and tribal governments. And the reason I bring this up is because I'm wondering, I understand like the need, you know, we keep hearing the need to obviously get money out to people, no question. But like when you look at states like California, for example, that's completely different than how Connecticut handled things. It's a little frustrating, I think, for some of like, you know, the people who live here in Connecticut who don't understand why we're waiting on money, because there's controversy over should we be spending extra money going to places like California because the governor refuses to open up places and doesn't want to move on opening the economy more. What are sort of your thoughts on this? I'd love to kind of dive into it a little bit.
Yeah, so I mean, I'll say two things about that. Number one, that the ethic here has to be to solve the problem, right? To get the pandemic under control. And you say that California may not be opening up fast enough. My gosh, California has more deaths and more new cases. I don't know if it's the most in the country, but California has one of the worst pandemic situations in the country. And so, you know, the idea that it should be quickly out of the box reopening restaurants to make an already awful situation worse strikes me as odd. But look, the second thing I'll say is that, yeah, there's a whole bunch of things in this bill, because it's huge, that are subject to debate. Look, I'll tell you, I personally think the bill may be a little bit too big. Economists are saying that, you know, and it's sort of ironic. 10 years ago, when we did the stimulus bill under Barack Obama after the whole mortgage meltdown mm-hmm. nightmare, the bill was too small, and that's part of the reason why we had a slow recovery in 2010, 2011. This one may be too big. A lot of economists are saying that you're really doing too much, and that's going to have implications, possibly inflationary, and also it could crowd out other stuff you want to do. Mm-hmm. It has stuff that we could debate, you know, the $15 minimum wage, which I actually think may, I don't know, it feels to me like that one may not make it into the final version of the bill. So I'm not going to tell you that there aren't some things in the bill that if it were just me, I would change, including possibly what you're talking about, although I'm not sure California is the case to hold up there. But look, you know, we had another 4,000 Americans die yesterday, right? So mm-hmm. it's not like we've got, you know, 6 months to debate a good chunk of this. So, you know, it turns out when there's 535 people who vote on this stuff, you don't always get the perfect bill.
Yeah. Well, I guess you actually touched on it perfectly. I think the way you just said it is exactly, I guess, my point. So like you brought up the $15 an hour wage. I agree with you. You know, like I look at state to state, like Connecticut put it into place that by 2023, our minimum wage workers will have $15 an hour. I think this is where it becomes confusing, and I don't know why we address it in the same bill. Like, if the goal here is to give people relief from the pandemic, like, we should just be, I feel like, looking at stimulus money, vaccine rollout, making schools safe. We all need that. Every state needs it. But then when we start to look at, like, okay, this state needs $15 an hour minimum wage, and it's like, but there are states that already have things in place. Or, for example, and the reason I bring up California is because I think that continues to be, like, the jarring example of, like, the example of Disney World versus Disneyland. Why they're, you know, why is one open and the other's not? You know, things like that. So I just feel like some states, you know, are more aggressive with what they're doing and they have policies in place. And I just think that's when it becomes confusing. Like, we're using, I feel like, this stimulus package as something bigger than it should be. And people aren't getting relief at the end of the day. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah. I probably agree with you that this thing is bigger than it needs to be. There's a lot of economists, including Larry Summers, who's a former Treasury Secretary, mm-hmm. who are writing that this thing is a little bit bigger. So, again, we're probably not going to hit perfection here. It is true, though, and again, remember, I mean, 4,000 Americans died yesterday, and on average, 4,000 Americans have been dying every single day for the last month or
right.
so. I mean, that's just mind-boggling. When you have a problem of that magnitude, you move fast, right? And what the problem with the last bill that we passed, I guess it was in December, was that it took 8 or 9 months to do it.
Exactly.
Now, fortunately, those weren't months where 4,000 Americans were dying every single day.
Right.
But now we're acting fast. And I'm going to agree with you that this thing has stuff in it that isn't directly related to solving the COVID thing. But let's take the $15 minimum wage. You know, that is a policy. At least we can have a good argument, and I might even agree with you that in a perfect world we would do this stuff separately. It makes me crazy when I have to vote on big bills that have all sorts of different stuff
right.
in it. But
I'm sure.
At least with the $15 minimum wage, that's a policy that has very, very substantial support around the country, including, by the way, in the state. Yeah, Connecticut, which is a Democratic place, passed a $15 minimum. The state of Florida, which is about as Republican as you get in the last election, also passed a $15 minimum wage.
Right.
So I at least take some comfort in the notion that these are policies that have very substantial support amongst the American people.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that's the biggest thing is I think either agree to disagree or on the same page somewhat. I do think that there's stuff in this bill that makes complete sense. I just think when you're talking about delaying people getting money, vaccines not getting into people's arms, and schools not being able to open up because we don't have the money to make them safe, I think it becomes a problem. And I wish we could just simplify it. I know that probably sounds very elementary to say, but I don't know why we can't simplify it more. Just to
well,
pass it.
The good news about this bill is it may be too big, but it's going to happen fast. I mean, I think we may be done with it today, right? And when you think about that versus where we were last year when it took 7 months
mm-hmm.
To get the bill that we passed in December done. So, and I'm glad you mentioned it because the other good thing about this bill, again, it may be too big, but it also has very substantial funds for schools to get everything they need to reopen. So we'll see. Next week when we talk, we'll see. But I do suspect that next week when we talk, this thing will be done and passed, and the aid will be getting out there.
Congressman Jim Himes, always appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much. We'll talk again next week.
Thanks, Melissa. Take care.
All right, you too.
What's happening in Hartford and how it affects you? Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly joins Melissa in the morning now on WICC 600.
Senator Kelly, so glad that you're with us this morning. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Yourself, Melissa?
I'm okay. Thank you so much for asking. So I think you and a lot of our listeners know my father owns a brokerage, an insurance brokerage in Fairfield. My husband and my brother are partners with my father, and my husband came home last night pretty beside himself. He got a copy of the bill that is going forward, this public health option, a 35-page document. I woke up to a whole list of notes from my husband. And basically, it looks like, I mean, and of course, I need to look through it myself, but a lot of the big things that seem to be of trouble is this idea of giving small groups kind of this like public health option, almost like extending the health exchange, which would take brokers out of the equation. I don't know the exact amount of people who are brokers here in Connecticut. I believe last year, and I could be wrong, I'll double check it, I believe it was something like 9% of our workforce are made up of insurance brokers. You know, taking them out of the equation, I know that, again, you're looking at a lot of people who need to afford health insurance, but there has to be another way without people losing their jobs.
Well, Melissa, there is a better way. And I think this is the distinction between the two parties. You know, right now, the majority in Hartford is coming in with a public option. And the public option, like our plan, which is reinsurance, is aimed to reduce premium 20%. Okay, we can both achieve that. However, the public option achieves it by being very disruptive to the insurance industry. It actually goes into direct competition to ultimately eliminate the insurance industry. We're the insurance capital of the world. This might work. Public options may work in Arkansas or someplace else, another state. But in Connecticut, we have jobs, and you referenced, you know, good-paying middle-class jobs. And Republicans have put forward a reinsurance program that not only can reduce premium, it also gets its arms around the real cost driver, which is medical care, and keeps good-paying jobs. What the Democrats are proposing is a public option that actually utilizes the exchange to expand Medicaid, and what they're doing is getting rid of asset limits and looking at more of a concept of Medicaid for all, as if people going on a welfare program is something to be aspired to. And quite frankly, I don't even know how anybody would buy onto a welfare program, because you're not supposed to have income and assets to be on Medicaid to begin with. And our plan provides, you know, this care. It's going to provide relief for middle-class families. And the concept is to lower premium. The other thing about their public option is that it's going to put Connecticut taxpayers at risk and doesn't go to look to leverage Washington dollars to bring those back to Connecticut.
Yeah, I was going to say, who's going to pay for this public option?
Well, from my reading of the bill, they'd like the Connecticut taxpayers to pay for it ultimately. They're going to say they look at getting people to pay. It's a government-run program where you're going to pay a fee to participate in this program. But it's not insurance, so it doesn't have all the guarantees of the Affordable Care Act. It's not regulated by the insurance department to make sure that it's actuarially sound. If it's not, then the Connecticut taxpayers are at risk to pay for this cost. And that's what the real problem is ours is going to have all the protections of the Affordable Care Act. It's going to be regulated by the Connecticut Insurance Department. I don't understand why you wouldn't want to use the best regulators in the country and provide citizens all the protections of the Affordable Care Act. This is what you hear Democrats talk about all the time. It's their criticism of Washington Republicans, is that they don't want to provide these protections. But now when offered that choice, they're turning their back on it. And I just can't believe, when we're dead last in the nation in job growth, Democrats would seek a policy to put more people in Connecticut out of work. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, and at the end of the day, like you said, so, okay, you save on your health insurance costs, but then you're paying more in taxes. So, like, really, what are we doing here? It doesn't.
The thing too here is, this bill was just released yesterday, and I understand that it's been out and been circulated among Democrat circles for a couple weeks. And next week, I believe it's February 9th, is the next Tuesday, is the public hearing on this. And so, you know, if listeners want to weigh in on this, they should certainly go to the cga.ct.gov website and look up and get the link to this public hearing if they'd like to put their input in on and talk about this project. This proposed bill, because, like I say, we've got a solution that works for the middle class and can provide premium relief, get, you know, the cost of medical care under control, and keep good-paying Connecticut jobs. I think it just makes abundant sense, and I don't know why it doesn't resonate with the majority.
Yeah, and actually, just so people know, that's how I found out about it. Senator Huang tapped my dad to testify on Tuesday, so... I don't know what he's going to say, but I'll be watching for sure to see what his testimony is. But yeah, I would definitely encourage people. This is like one of those things that really, it may sound like it's good in the news or the headlines, whatever they are, but I really would urge people that the best kind of voters, the best kind of people involved in politics are the ones who know their research. And this is one of those things where it sounds like free public option, you know, it, like you hear all these big words that sound great, but you have to ask the question, how are you making this happen and who is going to get their knees cut for this to go on? So, yeah, I would encourage people to check that out. Talking to Senator Kelly this morning. Something else, Senator, that I noticed this week, actually, you put an online petition out, SenatorKevinKelly.com, urging people to speak out against Senator Looney's Connecticut House tax proposal. Talk a little bit about that and what you're looking for people to do.
Well, as if the public option in killing Connecticut jobs wasn't enough, the other proposals that came forward was both this property tax, because Senator Looney and the Democrats believe a mansion is a home valued at $400,000 or more.
Which is insane.
And it's just adding a property tax to take money out of our local communities that's normally used for education and paving and I'm going to say plowing roads, and take that money to Hartford so they can send it to another community. And that is just that this time we can't afford it. But then, you know, as if that wasn't bad enough, we saw a proposal from Connecticut Democrats to create a $4 billion, that's a billion with a B, tax increase. That would be like the biggest tax increase in Connecticut's history. And I don't recall any Democrat running on that platform in November. But this would make Dan Malloy's tax increases look like the minor leagues. Wow. They've already proposed gas taxes, 17 cents, a mileage tax. There's tolls. I mean, the middle class is just getting barraged. And this is what I think happens when voters put all their confidence and all their political power in the Connecticut Democrats. The middle class becomes, you know, the target. And we're trying to get that message out that people need to pay attention. You know, and we do show better ways, Melissa. We do have a solution to transportation that can make the investment without tolls and new taxes. We have a solution on health insurance. We know that families are struggling and they have premiums, the cost of mortgage payments, but we do it in a way that leverages money from Washington, also keeps good-paying Connecticut jobs, and has an answer. The Democrats are disruptive in this area and ultimately put the burden on the middle-class wallet and now their house.
Senator Kevin Kelly, thank you so much for coming on, talking about these things. I know I could talk to you for another hour about so many things happening, but I'm glad we'll be chatting again next week, and you're on every week. Thank you so much for making the time every week. We appreciate it.
It's no problem. Thank you.
Connecting right now with Kevin Dillon, who's the executive director of the Connecticut Airport Authority, and the CAA operates Bradley International Airport. Kevin, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Yes, great to be with you, too. So, Kevin, I wanted to be able to kind of talk. I know every time we've had you on, we sort of do like almost like quarterly updates to see how our airports are doing, our commercial airlines and everything. First of all, talk to us a little bit about how, you know, innovative and proactive Bradley International Airport has been when it comes to making sure people are safe. We're still getting flights out. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. We've put a lot of effort into reinstilling passenger confidence. You know, we knew when the pandemic started, that was going to be the name of the game, is to reinstill confidence so that people felt safe flying. So we put a lot of effort into that here at Bradley. We've certainly enhanced all of the cleaning and sanitizing protocols throughout the terminal building. We've changed a lot of our procedures here to minimize employee and passenger contact. We were one of the first airports, quite frankly, in the country that mandated that you had to wear masks throughout your entire trip through the terminal building. And certainly our airline partners jumped on board with that very early on as well. So we have established a pretty extensive public information campaign so that people that haven't traveled in a while can understand what to expect when they come to Bradley Airport. You can go on bdlcares.com, and it'll tell you everything that the airport's done to make your trip safer, as well as what our airline partners have done. You know, I've told people that I feel it's actually safer to travel than it is to be in a supermarket these days. So we have really stepped up our game here at Bradley.
And I know that Bradley also has two COVID testing sites right there. Talk to us about that.
We do. You know, when the state introduced the travel advisory last June, we knew it was going to be very difficult for people to travel and then have to quarantine once they complete their trip or quarantine, you know, upon arrival here in Connecticut. Very, very difficult, as you can imagine, for a business traveler to try to figure out how do I get into Connecticut, quarantine, and then conduct my 1 or 2 days business. So we pushed throughout the summer to get a testing option so that if you did get a negative COVID test, you could end the quarantine period. So in September, we were finally able to convince the state to do that. And as a result, we opened up a couple of testing sites right here at Bradley. We have a site in the terminal building. It's located in our baggage claim area. That's run by Genesis Labs. It's open to any passenger who is traveling that day, either in or out. It's been very, very popular. Since it opened in September, they have actually administered well over 35,000 tests here at Bradley.
Wow. Wow.
We also have a second site that we opened in partnership with Hartford Healthcare. That operates in our outdoor parking lot, number 3. That's not only available to passengers as an overflow from the Genesis site inside the terminal, but we allow the general public to utilize that site as well. So that's been a very popular option as well. I mean, one of the things that we also recently are very proud of, we recently received our ACI health accreditation. ACI is a major worldwide airport organization. It represents airports around the globe. ACI has established a health accreditation process where they come in and they review all of the measures that you've undertaken. And if you can meet their very, very high standards, you receive this health accreditation. So we are now one of the few airports in the country that have received that accreditation.
Talking this morning to Kevin Dillon, who is with the CAA, the Connecticut Airport Authority, which overlooks Bradley International Airport. Now, Kevin, I was reading actually earlier this week, we actually got a notification because our family is flying to Florida next week. We got a notification from JetBlue, which it sounds like is an executive order that's gone into effect, I should say, a federal mask mandate, I should say. That's going to go for all airlines. It started February 2nd. I know it's kind of more of like a TSA topic, but I wanted to know, in your professional opinion, what you thought this was going to be for, like, a trickling effect for commercial airlines. So the mandate now requires anyone over the age of 2 to wear their mask during the duration of the flight. And I called JetBlue because this is one of my biggest concerns, and I was terrified this was going to happen. I can't believe it happened right, like, a week before we left. But, like, my 2.5-year-old is horrendous with his mask, and I think he will. I think he will do it. I think we'll be okay. But, you know, in calling JetBlue, they said, "Look, like, you can make as many doctor's notices as you want. Doesn't matter that you're immune because we had COVID already." Everything under the sun, they were like, look, we will turn people away. And immediately, I wasn't really from a selfish standpoint saying, whoa, like, you'll turn us away. Okay. It was more of, well, now what does that mean for the airlines? Like, when you're talking about 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds now having to wear the mask for the whole flight, that could be to Florida, that could be to California, wherever they're going. Now that airlines have that in place, do you think it's going to impact flight numbers even more?
You know, I don't. I think here at Bradley, you know, as I said before, we very early on required masks to be worn in the terminal building, and all of our airline partners at that point were already requiring it. The change that you're referencing is now a new federal mandate, which requires it at every airport across the country. So it really is just recodifying what's been done at Bradley all along, right since the start of the pandemic.
Okay.
Now, certainly, you know, as you point out, it is a challenge with children, you know, asking them to come into the terminal building, spend an hour or so in the building, then maybe a couple of hours on a flight it's a challenge to keep a mask on a two-year-old, and I think we all understand that. But what we, you know, are pressing is for parents to, you know, do the best that they can to comply with this new federal regulation, because while it's not the airport's responsibility per se to enforce it, it's really a TSA responsibility that's been put upon them. They do have the obligation to deny people boarding if they're refusing to wear the mask. But, you know, I would expect that the TSA and everyone will be using good judgment in terms of how that's enforced.
Sure. And I think it makes sense, Kevin. You know, I think as much as it's like, you know, it is hard for parents, it's also understandable. Look, I think airlines right now, I mean, I don't know if you have any facts or figures on you, but I mean, airlines right now are struggling to get commercial flights out and to fill those flights up. And you don't want to be a super spreader. You don't want to find out that your one flight now takes down a whole airline because there was no mask mandate. I mean, it makes sense. Yeah. It totally does.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, again, as I said earlier, this is all about, you know, reinstilling confidence in people to fly. Because right now, you know, we're, 11 months into the pandemic, and we are still down on any given day somewhere between 70 to 75% in terms of passengers, you know, as compared to a similar time period prior to the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So that has a direct impact on not only the airport, but certainly all of our airline partners, our concessionaires, the rental car companies that are suffering greatly and are very much looking forward to the day when we can start to resume some level of normalcy.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you talk to industry experts, a lot of folks are not expecting airlines and airports to return to pre-pandemic levels until 2024.
That's crazy.
So there's going to be a lot of challenges between now and then. And, you know, if you just focus on the airport challenges, you know, that 75% drop in passengers directly correlates to a drop in revenue coming into the airport.
Yeah.
Right? Because if people aren't flying, we're not collecting parking revenues, we're not collecting concession revenues, people aren't
renting
cars.
Right, it's a trickle effect.
So there's a direct impact and a very significant impact on the airport.
Kevin, we appreciate you coming on, and I hope to talk to you in a couple months. Maybe we'll have some better news then. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Yeah, we appreciate it.